It's different from last time.
He charted a change of course for the Catholic Church the fateful morning the passing of Francis, the first pope born outside Europe in more than a millennium. The native of Buenos Aires brought his years of parish work in working-class neighborhoods to the high halls of the Vatican with him. In his 12 years as sovereign pontiff, Francis championed the cause of migrants, climate action, civil unions for homosexuals, talked up reform inside a church worn down by declining attendance and sex scandals. The Pope's very last audience on Easter Sunday with J.D. Vance showcased the struggle between reformers and conservatives. J.D. Vance, the U.S. vice president, espousing a more traditional line, that of the American clergy, and a less clement reading, perhaps, of the scriptures. So what next? Naturally, we'll ask about succession and the direction of a Catholic Church that's a reflection, really, of a world that's again, it seems, today at a crossroads. Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about the legacy of Pope Francis. With us, Father Brice de Malherbe, theology professor at the Paris Diocese Faculté Notre-Dame School of Theology.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
With us as well, journalist Tom Hennigan, former religion editor at the Reuters news agency. How are you, Tom?
Fine, thanks. Nice to be here.
Vivian Waltz, Paris correspondent for Time magazine. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
And you can listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. First Latin American, first Jesuit, first Pope to take the name of Francis. That's in honor of the 13th century friar, Francis of Assisi, hailed for his modest living and the care of outcasts. Fadika Bayel has more.
The white smoke spiraling from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel made Jorge Maria Bergoglio the first non-European pope in 1300 years. Born in Argentina in 1936 to Italian immigrant parents, he grew up in a modest family in Buenos Aires. During his studies, Jorge Bergoglio worked as a janitor and a nightclub bouncer, an unusual profile, but one that didn't prevent him from climbing the ladder within the church. He was appointed bishop, then archbishop, before being appointed as Cardinal of Buenos Aires in 2001. Nicknamed Prince of the Poor, he made clear he wouldn't live in the Vatican like his predecessors, instead choosing to reside at St. Martha's Guesthouse with other clergy members.
I was wondering, why did you give up all the wealth of a pope?
I have a need to live among the people.
For his first visit outside Rome, the pontiff chose the Italian island of Lampedusa, where thousands of migrants died attempting to reach its shores. Pope Francis also spoke out for societal stances like homosexuality.
If a person is gay and willingly seeks the Lord, who am I to judge?
Whilst it was a change in message, it wasn't a change in doctrine, as the Vatican reaffirmed that homosexuality is a sin. Pope Francis's statements have been controversial within the Catholic Church, who have tried to maintain unity within it. In February 2019, the Pope held an unprecedented international summit where he said that the Church was ready to take responsibility for abuse against children.
The Church will do whatever is necessary to bring to justice anyone who has committed such crimes.
Pope Francis also emphasized a more inclusive Catholic Church, but this earned him criticism of conservatives who accused him of diluting the Church's teachings. And a stinging criticism of the Curia, the Church's central government, meant many in the Vatican have long wanted to see him go. After an exhausting journey to Canada in July, he hinted he might follow the unusual example set by his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, and resign from the role.
This, with all honesty, is not a catastrophe. There can be a change of popes.
For his critics, Francis did not behave like a pope should. But his supporters will remember him for his simplicity, vibrant personality, and his empathy for the poor.
A break with the past with this pope. And again, if you're just joining us, we have just had a mass at Paris's Notre Dame. There's one taking place at Westminster. There you see images from Kinshasa at the bottom of your screen. And of course, St. Peter's Square in Rome in this a jubilee year on an Easter Monday. Father Brice de Malherbe. It's only a moment that I've only known four times in my lifetime, the passing of a pope. It is a rare moment. And this one, what does it mean for you? How does this one resonate?
Well, you know, it makes me think of when St. John Paul II passed away, because it was more or less the same period of Easter. And I think it's significant that the last words of Pope Francis was "Happy Easter," which is really the core of the mission of the Church, to say, okay, Christ, we believe he is really the Redeemer, and Easter is the resurrection of Christ, which brings hope. You know, the Holy Father had just last December began the Jubilee of Hope, and I think it's one of his last messages to the world, to say, okay, we're full of crisis, economic crisis, conflicts in the world, let's work on it, but let's have hope. And I think that's very important.
And his last action, you might say, his last public action, was that surprise little trip he did on Easter Sunday in St. Peter's Square. It hadn't been announced publicly. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think really I'd like to pay homage to the courage of this man and the fact that he really wanted to serve the Church till the very end of his life. I mean, it's quite impressive. I mean, when you have someone of 88 with all the health problems he went through, and we've seen in the different extracts we had that the courage he had to walk about. I mean, impressive, really.
Tom Hennigan, is it a moment of surprise? After all, he'd spent 38 days in hospital starting in February, or not?
He was a pope of surprises. He liked a surprise, but if you know him well enough, you'd say, wait a minute, he loves to have contact with the people. And he said that from the beginning, he needed contact. And so the fact that he went out on Easter Sunday in the Popemobile was, on the one hand, a surprise, but on the other hand, not a surprise at all, because he was there with the people, and that's what he wanted.
12 years, and in those 12 years, he had time to take that message of championing the poor, and as we saw in that report, bit of a, how do we say it, a showdown with more traditionalists.
Absolutely, until the very, you know, very last moment, as Tom says. It was a tactile pope. And of course, he defied the orders of his own doctors by going out yesterday in the Popemobile and being among the crowds. And one has to kind of wonder whether, for him, it was a goodbye in his mind, and that was the only way that he was going to say goodbye, not somebody who was going to sort of fade out into in the darkness, if you like, but one that was going to be among the people. And that really kind of encapsulated, I think, what the world knew of this pope.
A pope a papacy would mark a break with the course charted by his predecessors. And we sort of touched on a little bit in that previous report. Siobhan Silk has more on what changed and what didn't on Francis's watch.
When Jorge Mario Bergoglio became Pope Francis in 2013, he was immediately hailed as a new type of leader, a progressive following decades of conservatism under his predecessors Benedict XVI and John Paul II. And he seemed set to upend some of the long-time teachings of the Roman Catholic Church.
There are some things to reform. The Church always has to reform itself.
From the beginning, Pope Francis reached out to the LGBTQ+ community, long marginalized by the Church. He said it was not up to him to judge them, and he was vocal in condemning laws against homosexuality.
Being homosexual isn't a crime, it's part of the human condition.
He continued to say no to same-sex marriage, but in 2023 approved blessings for same-sex couples, though he clarified that priests could bless the two people in the relationship, but not the union itself. While Francis criticized what he called gender ideology, which he said sought to erase differences between women and men, he broke bread with transgender people and said they should be accepted.
The fact that Pope Francis is bringing transgender people closer to the church is a beautiful thing, because we need some love.
Francis did sometimes stumble. In 2024, the Vatican apologized after he used a homophobic slur when he was speaking in private about his opposition to allowing gay men into the priesthood, a change that did happen this year. There are still no female priests in the Catholic Church, let alone bishops or cardinals. And despite hopes that that might have begun to change under Francis,
ordain women!
Ordain women!
He ruled out the ordination of women. But during his papacy, women gained more influence than ever in the highest echelons of the Catholic Church. He appointed a number of women to senior leadership positions in the Vatican. Francis resisted calls to re-examine the rule of celibacy for priests, but in his later years, he showed signs of bending on this. In the face of a crisis of recruitment to the priesthood, he talked of rethinking the rule in locations where there was a shortage of clergy. Marriage is sacred and divorce is impossible under Catholic law, but Francis called for more understanding, saying the Catholics who have civil divorces and remarry should not be shunned by the Church. There were some red lines that were impossible for Francis to cross. He always remained unmoving on the Catholic Church's complete opposition to contraception and abortion.
The sentence of respect for life, proclaiming the sacredness of the every human life from conception to natural death.
He also reaffirmed the Church's opposition to in vitro fertilization and called for a global ban on surrogate pregnancy.
A child is always a gift and never the object of a commercial contract.
Francis may not have been the sweeping reformer that progressive believers had hoped for, but the late Pope changed the tone of the Vatican. He helped people who once believed the Catholic Church had no place for them to feel more welcome. And he pushed the institution to live up to the meaning of its name, the Universal Church.
And we are joined in our conversation from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, by Massimo Fagioli, professor of theology at Villanova University. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you.
Not the sweeping reformer that the most progressive Catholics would have liked, but how would you rate how much Francis has changed the tone and the conversation inside the Church over these 12 years?
He was a reformer not by the book, not by changing books, but he was a reformer in the sense of opening up to conversations that until 2013 were forbidden or taboo or uncomfortable, and now they have become really part of the official conversations of the Catholic Church. The most important thing he did was that he made clear that Catholicism is not a Western ownership, is not a European franchise with some local adaptations, it's something really global. And this means a series of things at institutional level, cultural, theological, but also on issues like environment or capitalism, with the radicalism that made him persona non grata to some politicians, some intellectuals, in ways that were not predictable, easy before he was elected.
Was this a surprise for you? Did you expect him to be that way when he was the one that was chosen?
It was a surprise for many, also because he was a Jesuit, also because he was not an insider of any circle within the Vatican, not even within the Jesuits, to be honest, but conclaves are often sources of surprise. What has been most surprising for me as a European working in the United States has been the violence of the position against him almost instantly, a few days, few weeks after he was elected. That was the most surprising thing that I've seen in this pontificate.
That's interesting. Father Brice de Menelbe, the reaction there from Massimo as an Italian living in the United States to see that right away, this sort of polarization that he witnessed being in the United States, where the church is more traditionalist.
Yes, of course. I think two words are important, of course, a lot of others, but to understand Pope Francis's teaching is justice and mercy. You see, social justice, which means at the same time taking care of migrants and taking care of the unborn child. It is a profound unity, you know, to see this importance of the attention to all vulnerability and then mercy. Say, okay, we're all called to holiness, we're all called to perfection, but we all have trouble, you know, on our way to holiness and perfection. So there's not a club of all the good ones and then the bad ones. But we all have to have this understanding, as it was said in the previous...
And is Massimo Fagioli correct when he says that he opened the church to conversations that the church did not have before?
Absolutely, absolutely. Synodality, of course, is another great word of saying, okay, let's not put aside, you know, the difficult questions and sort of pretend they're not there. It's a very Jesuit way of doing things. You know, just everything has to come to light. And then you have discernment. Okay, what can be done? Where can we move? What can't we accept? And let's go forward that way. And if we're not exactly on the 100% right line, well, never mind. We're trying to advance.
Tom Hennigan, explain for us what it is a Jesuit and whether being the first Jesuit pope is perhaps as important, more important than being the first Argentine pope.
They're both important. It's hard to say. If you're a Jesuit, as Father says, you like discussion, you like different opinions. They let within the Jesuit order, they allow a lot of debate. At a certain point, then they say, okay, fine, and then the decision is made, and then there's obedience comes after that. What Francis did was first bring that into the regular church, into the Vatican and the stodgy old church. And secondly, as an Argentinian, he brought a very different view of world affairs, a very different view of the church in the world to the Vatican than people had before. It had been a monopoly of Europeans before that. And suddenly you get an Argentinian who, for example, would not take sides between Ukraine and Russia. He never denounced Putin for invading Ukraine, because as you've seen from further apart, you get a different view of things. So both of those were important.
Is that, when it came to Ukraine and Russia, was it also because of his trying to get this idea of an ecumenical understanding, being the first pope to travel to the Arabian Peninsula, for instance?
Yeah, sure. The ecumenism was very much a part of his outlook. And therefore, the Vatican would have a different foreign policy from a Western country, for example, even though it is physically in a Western country.
Back in 2016, the pope performing the foot washing ritual for asylum seekers at a refugee center near Rome, and that in defiance at the time of anti-migrant rhetoric in Europe and the U.S. Let me ask you this, Vivian Walt. Those the Time magazine, I know, has been showing those images from 2016 as significant. In the way that we had a cold warrior, if you will, with Pope John Paul II, how would you characterize, if you're going to attach a man to his times, this pope?
This really was a pope that was perfect for this moment. He wasn't only the first pope to come from the Southern Hemisphere, although he was actually just first generation. Let's admit that he's the son of Italians. But he was also the first pope in an age of true global communications. And that gave him access immediately, instantaneous access to hundreds of millions of Catholics around the world in a way that his predecessors never had.
Let's talk about this. It's, 2013 when he becomes pope. At the time, you already have social media, but it's not on steroids, if you will, the way it is today.
Not at all. Here is a pope that could put out a message instantaneously on Twitter, on TikTok, on a number of different platforms that would be instantly reached in every single corner of the world in any language he chose. And I think that was really, really crucial at a time when the church had undergone years of scandal and decline, as Father Brice was mentioning, that declining numbers, that he could reach just vast numbers of people with a message that at the same time ran exactly counter to a message that was coming out of Washington, out of certain capitals in Europe that were very anti-immigrant, anti-migrant. And he pushed another line, which was climate. He's been very vocal about a ceasefire in Gaza, issues that might have been seen as not the role of a pope became very much his message.
Let's go now to St. Peter's Square and France 24 correspondent Seema Gupta. Seema, we see the faithful have been gathering for a rosary prayers mass.
Exactly. I mean, essentially, it's a vigil, if you like. When someone does pass, they pray the rosary, and the Vatican announced that at 7:30 local time, people are invited to turn up at St. Peter's Square and to participate in this a collective mourning, if you like. There's been a death in the larger family, in the family of Catholics around the world. And so the feeling is that people will want to come and pray together. I have been speaking to people gathered here. Obviously, it's Easter Monday. It's also the Jubilee year. You have lots of tourists, lots of pilgrims, and Romans as well, all wanting to come here. Many said that they were shocked when they heard the news. They felt it was necessary to make this appearance here at St. Peter's Square, which is just behind me. They're entering the square slowly, and that prayer vigil, the rosary, will begin at 7:30. At 8 p.m., just half an hour after that, we understand from the Vatican that inside the Vatican, they will be moving the body of the Pope into the coffin. That, of course, a very significant moment, and also perhaps later on this evening, as soon as they know the specific cause of death, he possibly will be examined by doctors. They will be able to inform us of the exact cause of death of Pope Francis. But you know, he was in hospital for 5 weeks battling double pneumonia and still undergoing respiratory physiotherapy and other treatments, including the use of oxygen when he needed it. So clearly, he was in a weak state, an 88-year-old man. But right now, the moment is really about prayer. Prayer together to remember the life of the Pope and to mourn together.
I can tell you, Seema, that there are more faithful coming your way. We just saw in those live images the people making their way towards St. Peter's Square. Thank you for that live update. We'll be checking back in with you throughout. Tom Hennigan was talking earlier about this notion of dialogue. Is it antithetical to what Vivian Walt was saying? Because in the age of social media, does that lend itself to dialogue or to echo chambers?
That's a good question. I do find is that very often people misunderstand the Catholic Church because they think in terms of left and right and in political terms. And the Church teaches things that to a politically minded person would seem like partly conservative and partly very liberal. And so it's hard to say. Is social media the way to get across? It's certainly effective partially. We see that, for example, in the baptisms here in Europe, there's more and more young people being baptized, becoming Catholics. Why is that? And part of it is social media. We don't know. But it's a good question.
All right, so people's politics sort of projected when they look at this moment. We talked about the message of Pope Francis in favor of the outcast, in favor of migrants. The Pope would cross swords with Donald Trump and his vice president, J.D. Vance, who was greeted for a private audience on Easter Sunday at the Vatican just a day ago. It was an audience there that you saw with the Pope that was very short. And then a longer exchange would ensue with Vatican Secretary of State Pietro Parolin, one officially depicted as cordial, despite reports that the U.S. vice president, who had talked in the past about concentric circles of love. You love your family more than your neighbors. You love your neighbors more than your countrymen, etc. Well, he got a lecture on Christian values, it seems, one compounded by the Pope's Easter address. And in that address, the Pope saying that how much contempt is stirred up at times towards the vulnerable, the marginalized, and the migrants. Again, Massimo Fagioli, picking up on the point made by Tom Hennigan, you project. So if you're somebody who likes Donald Trump, you don't necessarily appreciate that message. If you're somebody who dislikes Donald Trump, you're rooting for the Pope without thinking about it a little bit in partisan terms.
There's something like that, certainly, but it's not a matter of personalities and not even a matter of policies. This is the greatness of Pope Francis. European and Western Catholicism for these last 50 years were used to think about Catholicism in historical terms as something that makes sense in light of World War I, of World War II, of the Cold War. Pope Francis is a man of the global South for whom the center of history, of modern history, is decolonization. Colonialism and decolonization. So when he spoke about migrants and refugees and so on, he was not the American stereotypical bleeding heart liberal. He was a man of the South who was asking the world for justice, for a recognition of what history has brought to some parts of the world, not Europe, not North America, or some areas or some peoples of North America. This is the great clash of narratives. And so here, Pope Francis and Trump paradoxically had something in similar because they were two different kinds of populists, okay? But Pope Francis was on the side of those who were the losers of global history. And Donald Trump is for giving back to the winners something that they were starting to lose, or that they were thinking they were starting to lose. So the meeting with J.D. Vance of yesterday was highly, highly symbolic because it came 2 months after the letter of Pope Francis to the U.S. bishops, was one in a century document, because Pope Francis was clearly rebuking J.D. Vance's nationalist theology of migration and so on. So the big story geopolitically of this pontificate is a new global Catholic Church rising from the Vatican, and the United States, which is grappling with its identity crisis. Are we still a white European country, or are we a global South country, a woke Black Lives Matter, all of that?
Father Brice de Malherbe, among your students, among your parishioners, is that how it's seen, this sort of fight between the view of the global South versus the view of the Europeans, if you will, or the...
The situation, of course, as most of my students come from Europe, the situation and the analysis is a bit different from that on the other side of the Atlantic. But definitely, the Pope Francis has, and especially for us here in France, made it clear that the center of the Catholic Church is not Italy, is not France, is not Europe, that we have to think in, not in terms of center, and then all the rest has no importance, but on the contrary, to say the smallest community of Catholics in Mongolia, in Papuasia, New Guinea, has the same importance as communities in France or in Italy. And it's a whole. And that we all have to learn from one another.
Hence this Pope that goes to Corsica, first one ever, but not for the reopening of Notre Dame Cathedral.
For instance.
Is that the message he was sending by doing that?
I think so. Yes, to say, of course, the Papal Nuncio was there in Notre Dame and read an important message from the Holy Father. But indeed, to say, look here, chaps, you know, you have to listen to everyone. You talked about social media. I'm personally convinced, but I'm ready to have a debate on this, that the presence of social media is one of the main reasons why the Holy Father said, okay, you cannot govern the church as you governed it 50 years ago. And he called for this synodality, saying, you have to gather everyone, okay. Decisions are made by the bishops, by the Holy Father. I think he was very, very personal sometimes in his way of deciding, and sometimes went sort of a bit aside from his own curia. But there's a direct link between this globalization of media and the fact of saying, You can't govern the church as you did.
And the reaction to globalization, the fear that it's all going too fast, resulting, some say, in the fact that you have anti-immigrant politicians on both sides of the Atlantic. Was the Pope right to send that message to the U.S. clergy, effectively calling them to order?
I think so. You know, you have to read his message up to the end. For instance, one of his last messages was to the American bishops in last January, to say it is legitimate for a state to regulate immigration. but you cannot treat people as if they weren't human beings. And it is very important, once again, you know, this Pope has had a very important saying, politics can be the utmost way of living charity if it is really lived as a service to people. And therefore, he was, as his predecessors, very attentive to injustice and to the fact that politicians could take decisions that were against common good.
Do you see that next pope coming from the global south? And if he comes from the global south, Vivian Walt, will he have that message of justice as described?
You know, of course, there's been a lot of talk about the next pope coming from Africa, where you have the fastest growing population of Catholics. It's something like 250 million Catholics in Africa now, and that number's growing at a far more accelerated rate than it is in the West, and the number of priests equally. But that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a progressive church. Despite what Pope Francis had to say, the African bishops made it clear that they did not intend to bless gay couples, for example, and there's a very strong strain of anti-homosexuality in the global south and particularly in Africa. So although it might be seen as a groundbreaking move to have the next pope be a black pope, and certainly extraordinary, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be a progressive move or that it will necessarily continue some of the more progressive moves that Pope Francis brought in.
Tom Hennigan, you talked about earlier about surprises from from a conclave. So what are your betting odds right now?
My betting odds is that it's the strangest election that you've ever seen or never seen. And and therefore, all
but aren't the cards stacked already since Francis has named a lot of key people?
The cards were stacked in 2005 that Benedict was going to be elected. I covered that. 2013 was a complete surprise. And since the late Pope first appointed cardinals from the peripheries, that means you don't know what they are, who they are, what they think. And secondly, never really made time when they came to Rome for them to get together and talk and get to know each other. It all bets are off. I personally think that it'll be a pope from the global south. I think that because that's the majority in the church, and they have now gone from the Italian monopoly to a Pole, then a German, then an Argentinian. They're not going to give that up. And I think that they would go for somebody from the global south. Who, though? That's a good question.
Massimo Fagioli, you agree?
It's a very unpredictable conclave because it's a much larger college of figures that are not very well known to the larger church, but not even to other cardinals. So I agree that having a pope from the global south doesn't necessarily mean a more progressive church. It could actually mean the opposite. I think that one important factor of context in this election that we did not have in 2005 or 2013 is the disruption of the global order. The church needs a pope who can speak and deal with Donald Trump, with Vladimir Putin, with China, with India, also for reasons of the protection of the freedom of religion of Catholics and non-Catholics in this country, which is increasingly under threat. So it's an unpredictable conclave because, as Tom was saying, he has enlarged the college, but he had called them much less frequently to be part of the government of the Catholic Church. It's something similar that we saw in the late 16th century, actually, when we have a kind of a demotion of the role of the cardinal from a senator to a minister. That was a big change in the 16th century, and it has come. It has become, again, how these cardinals are. Once you had the biggest names being archbishops of the major capitals, now it's not necessarily true. And so this makes the whole conclave more unpredictable.
If I understand you correctly, Massimo, there could be a backlash to the unpredictability. People may vote stability.
It's possible. It is possible because I see some similarities with the situation of 1939, when we had Pius the 11th, who had died after warning what fascism was about, what Nazism was about, quite late in his case, but he warned that. And the choice fell on the Secretary of State, was a man who was highly experienced in dealing with the foreign powers. I think that it's now a different situation, but with some similarities. So the situation of global disruption might make some cardinals think that we need a more traditional figure, more institutional, an insider maybe. It's one possibility, but there are so many unknowns. Much will depend on what kind of narrative shapes up in the next couple of weeks on the legacy of Francis, on the situation of the church. And talking about social media, if there will be an attempt to interfere with the conclave by trying to discredit some cardinals, this is something that has been tried in a non-conclave moment in previous years. So we should be ready for some kind of interference similar to what we have seen in U.S. elections in these next few years.
Father Brice de Malherbe, should we beware that there could be attempts to pressure the cardinals?
Certainly, but I think one of the last messages the late Pope has left us is hope. This jubilee of hope, and therefore I have no idea who will be elected, but I know that in faithfulness to our Savior, Pope Francis has called us for hope, so I have hope.
You have hope. His message over the years, and what's the one that will, we just heard it from Massimo, what's the one that will resonate? You know, again, this idea of the message of the global South, which isn't all peace and love at times. Once during an exchange with reporters on a 2015 trip from Sri Lanka to the Philippines, on board the plane, the Pope said, "It's true that you cannot react with violence. But if my aide, Dr. Gaspari, who's a friend, badmouths my mother," well, take a listen.
Ma sì, dottor Gaspari, grande amico, mi dice una parolaccia contro la mia mamma, ma gli aspetta un pugno. Ma è normale.
A punch would be coming his way. It would be normal, Vivian Walt.
I mean, he
how Christian
had
is that?
Wit. I think nobody could dispute that he really had wit.
Is that a very Christian message, though?
It may not be Christian, but it is witty.
What was it? What does that say, though? Again, about the shoes that are going to have to be filled now.
It says a lot about the character of the Pope. He was himself, and he was always very easygoing. People liked to talk to him, you know, and that was more important to him than following the rules exactly. What will happen after this? One thing that the Pope has done, he failed to reform some things. He also failed to name enough cardinals and let them get to know each other so that you could somehow make out what was going to happen. But he has said there's going to be another synod on synodality, and he set up a program for up until 2028. So whatever successor comes is already bound to see this through. And with synodality, you get the voice of the people coming in. It's no longer the Curia, the Vatican, telling Catholics what to think. There'll be more calls for reform.
Calls for reform?
There will continue to be calls for reform.
And what kind of reform?
Women's ordination, either as deacons or even further as priests. End of celibacy for priests. Things like that. LGBT unions being actually blessed in the church. These are well-known reform demands that people are making, and they will continue because of the system that he has set up, which is much more consulting the people and asking the basis, what do you think?
Is that perhaps as important, the synod that's coming up, as the name of the next pope?
Well, the pope is always free to continue or not what his predecessor has put ahead. But I mean, I agree with Tom that it would be very difficult for the next pope to say, okay, well, we're stopping everything. I mean, Paul VI continued, of course, the Vatican II Council that John the 23rd had put his set. We've heard the Holy Father saying the church always has to reform itself. On the other hand, the church is not a democracy. The Pope Francis was the first one to say. So I'm not sure the program that Tom has just set in front of us will be the program of the next synod. But although you have a lot of voices going in that way, but you also have Catholic dogma, and things can be reformed, but always in the living tradition.
Number one, to concentrate the mind on looking at that Catholic dogma, Massimo Fagioli, is it not the fact that you have competition for the church? I'm thinking most notably of Francis's native Latin America, where more and more are deserting the Catholic Church in favor of Pentecostal churches. Again, it's the question of what kind of a pope, what kind of a dogma do you have going forward?
Well, dogmas change very rarely. It's more about doctrine. So you're right. So we have seen what you have described for Latin America, but we have many other different movements. One that I think should be very high in the ranking of the priorities is that some countries like Germany, like Australia, have seen two generations of women leaving the church. This is not sustainable for any organization. So there are different continental situations. There is the tensions with Islam in Africa. There's the relationship with the very ancient religions of Asia. So what Pope Francis kept together was a Catholic Church that was visibly much more diverse in different continents. And the question is, more than doctrinal changes, is of local adaptations of what can be adapted. Because, I mean, let's remember, this is one Catholic Church from Alaska to Chile, from Indonesia to Africa, under one canon law. This, I don't know of any other organization that can work this way. And so this is something that is very complex to address. And that has to do with women in the church, the parish system. So more than doctrine, on which there's very little appetite to address some deep doctrinal issues, is how to